in this second, you know, rejuvenation that we're having now, creatively, I mean, it is again very much about relationship and, you know, working with the people who are kind of like your family, more than trying to put together like a strategic plan to take over the world or something.
That's Matt Easton of The Jenny Thing. I'm Jamie Green, and this is Trading Force. Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of Trading Force. I am your host, Jamie Green, and today we've got Matt Easton on from the California band The Jenny Thing, and we're going to talk all about that here in a second. I hope everybody had a great week. You know, it's been so much fun for me. I've been playing out a bunch, but I've also been able to see a lot of people that have been on this podcast outperforming. I actually went out to Jerry's Jam Night last week, where I got to see Brandon Miller in person. I hadn't seen Brandon. I got to see Go-Go Ray again. And just was so much fun just to be out and about listening to music. And I think that's the thing that kind of is the thread through this whole podcast, is that the love of music is a community activity. And that's true with everybody. So for today's guest, it's almost like a family situation. So The Jenny Thing was a band in Berkeley, California that started in the early 90s. And had some success and did some albums, and like a lot of things, you know, life happens and changes happen, and so they took a little break, but always got along, and one of the members of the band moved away, but then he moved back, and they're back, and they've got this great new album out, and you're listening to one of the tracks right now, American Canyon, so we had so much fun. So let's get started. Here's my conversation with Matt Easton of The Jenny Thing. So I've got to ask you to start this off, because I just found this fascinating. So I always read stuff that people send me. And the fact, Garage, you're the first person I've ever met that's been on this podcast that used GarageBand to do recording. And I think it's kind of funny, because I think most people, when they get GarageBand either on their Mac, on their, you know, their laptop or on their iPhone, their first inclination is to delete it, right? Unless they're a musician.
Right.
So Matt, why did you guys, I mean, you had Logic too. So what was the thing with GarageBand? Why were you so into that?
Yeah, well, I think actually, yeah, it's a little bit of a, I mean, it's not what it sounds like, in that the reason I like GarageBand so much is I treat it like a tape machine. So the last time I was seriously recording it at home, I had sort of a 10-year hole in my recording life. I was using ADATs. And I had a couple of those. I had one, and then for a hot second, I had two, and then I sort of dipped a foot into Pro Tools and got sort of grossed out. So anyway, the reason why is that, I mean, we have like a real front end on it, and I am kind of an audio nerd, but it's like GarageBand sounds good, and it's really fast. And today, Logic is almost exactly the same. But I will tell you that the number one reason that I backslid off of Logic back to GarageBand was, as soon as I bought Logic, all of the plugins and the instruments showed up in GarageBand also.
Okay.
Just with like slightly worse metering and like a few missing like little settings, but all the great audio and all the great synths that you get with Logic actually show up in GarageBand. So we're using a lot of Logic's bells and whistles, but we're lazy.
No, that makes sense. That's why I was curious, because I was like, well, that's interesting. Let's ask about that. So recording at home, I think most people will say that it's mostly a plus side. It's mostly a good thing. You mostly love it. On the minus side, I guess it's trying to make it sound as good as you would like it, right? Some of the sound dampening that you have some issues with. I mean, what would you tell people? What's the best part about it? What's the worst part about it?
Yeah, I think it's 100% good for us, but kind of like the GarageBand comment, I have a room. It's not that it's treated. It's very naturally forgiving. It's very medium, small, it's carpeted, it has wooden walls and ceiling, like paneling. So it's sort of a funky garage. You know, you can imagine some kids like playing Led Zeppelin in the back behind the garage in this house, you know, 50 years ago or whatever. But So it's a good room. I think that's like, you know, 90% of it. And then, you know, I have a lot of reasonable microphones and a good amount of technique at this point, you know, this many years on. So, I mean, we made and kind of assisted 3 studio records. And then I've sort of done similar on maybe 3 other records for other people. And I've done a little bit of engineering and production for other people. So I know enough to know what I don't know. And, right. And to take it really easy going in. And in fact, one thing we did during this record was really strip back what interesting things we were doing without board going in. So if you're enough of a nerd, like you'll know what like an 1176 is.
Yeah.
I actually got rid of, I mean, I had a clone, right? I had like a Chinese clone, but I just stopped using that because I felt like the mix engineer knew how to use that as a combination effect and tool.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I was painting him in a corner, he never said anything bad about anything I was sending him, but I just realized, you know, I like being in a kind of flow state, and there really are only, you know, there's probably 4 or 5 good ways to mic an electric guitar, and 2 of them are faster and 1 of them sounds good in my room. And so a lot of what we do is like super fixed channels, like all the way from the guitar to the microphone, and everything in between like just won't change. I think maybe behind you, do you have a like a Princeton Reverb or something there?
I've got, that's a 1983 Fender Super Champ.
Oh, Super Champ, neato. Okay, cool. Yeah. I've kind of always wanted this. Well, I have a 70s Princeton Reverb, and it's just like you don't mess with that thing, you know. It's just like you just keep plugging into it and stop reading magazines and just like track guitar. Your guitar life will be pretty good, you know, most of the time.
It's so funny. It's literally come out you're like the 3rd or 4th person. And I really honestly, I did not put that just as a, you know, not to get people's in, but I actually do home recording for fun here.
Nice.
So that just sits there. So I bought that like in 1986, like for what, like $285, which back then that was a lot of money back in 1986.
Right. Yeah.
And this thing has been with me. I mean, from college in Nebraska, I was in Austin, Texas for a while. I came here to Kansas City. My wife went to law school, graduated. She got a job out in Phoenix and went to Phoenix. It's been back here. And to your point, Matt, it's funny. I think I just like to put a nice Shure mic in front of it.
Yep.
And go. And it sounds great.
Yeah.
You know, I think we get so, you know, kind of like, you know, the squirrel, squirrel real quick. Like we get so fascinated with all the bells and the whistles and compression and all that stuff. And man, sometimes it's just, you take all that out and just get it. And anyway, so yeah, I love that amp. It's a fun amp. I will never get rid of it. So it's
never do. That's awesome.
So let's back up for people. So I'm mostly here in Kansas City. So for people that are hearing this, you know, most of my listeners are in Kansas City. Strangely, I have a fair amount of listeners in India of all places, which I still haven't figured out why, but, cool. Occasionally some people out on the West Coast, but for people that don't know the Jenny thing, this is an interesting story. So you guys are college guys at UC Berkeley, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. 2 of us met there. The kind of the core songwriting team met at Berkeley in the early 90s. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit. So Berkeley is known as a very, I don't want to say egghead. That's not right, but that's a serious place, right, Matt? So does that and rock and roll go together? Well, were you worried that you weren't taking your studies seriously enough? I mean, what was the feeling about that?
Right. Well, I'm sure I wasn't. But in retrospect, I have realized there was sort of this like high functioning, like try to do everything all at the same time kind of thing, which kind of we pulled off, you know, kind of. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a serious place, but it's also a very countercultural place and kind of a do-it-yourself place. So it's got a lot of texture and a lot of kind of facets to it here in Berkeley. And of course we have a great tradition of all of the, you know, kind of the Golden Gate Park Panhandle, the Dead, Jefferson Airplane, you know, and then up in Berkeley, particularly, we have the punk rock scene,
right,
which you don't hear in our sound much at all. But I do think there's kind of this ethos of, you know, make your own art happen, you know, don't worry too much about the audience. Other than the emotional audience, you know, I'm often thinking about just the small emotional audience, but and that's a scene unto itself, but it's also like comfort in like not plugging into a scene. And I mean, my earlier thought, like, you know, talking about like Jellyfish, Tony, or Faith No More, those are all also like, they're kind of seamless wonders, you know, they're just outside of plugging into a single genre or somebody else's fan base. It's like, I think there's a strong artistic ethos here.
Yeah. And I think that's too, for, you know, I'm 53. So for people that are old, you know, it was so much, music was much more organic, correct? It was much more, you were going to meet some friends and maybe you become a band. And then it's all about what you like, really. There wasn't 1,000 channels. There wasn't auto-tune. There wasn't American Idol. There wasn't, you know, it was basically you and your pals, you get together, you go to somebody's garage or basement, you rehearse enough that you think you're decent enough, and go play shows, right? It's almost become back ass words, where now it's like all the people do is sing, and they, you know, you auto-tune, and they are using Pro Tools back, and they kind of miss that organic piece of it. And I think that's, me personally, and maybe you think the same, or maybe you don't, that's like the best part of being in the band, correct?
Yeah. I mean, and certainly in our case, I mean, because part of what you're getting at is like a time when like friendship kind of ruled what it meant to be a musician. And it sort of wasn't about professionalizing it and specializing it from square one, which over time, but it, you know, it comes in waves. I mean, I think there have been periods of this that have come every decade or so. It'll, the pendulum will swing one direction or the other. I mean, it's funny, right? Looking at like something like Nirvana, who in many ways looked to throw a wrecking ball into the record industry, and also kind of remade the record industry, remade MTV for another generation. So there's some irony in that too. But in any case, yeah, with us, it is very much about the friendship. And, you know, in this second, you know, rejuvenation that we're having now, creatively, I mean, it is again very much about relationship and, you know, working with the people who are kind of like your family, more than trying to put together like a strategic plan, you right. know, to take over the world or something.
No, and it's the 90s are such a, and I listened to all your stuff. I went back and listened to your first album and your second album.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I always appreciate people who are true to themselves, right? I mean, there were certain bands, and I'm not going to call them out, that had started out a certain way. And then when grunge like kind of really went off, then they became grunge bands suddenly. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty common. Yeah.
Right. And so I appreciate that you had, you know, what, The Cure and The Smiths and who else? I'm just, this is off the top of my head from listening to you, who were like your big influences, and you just wanted to kind of grow.
There. I mean, Cure, Smiths, New Order definitely are kind of like touchstones, and sometimes we lean harder into one or the other. I think New Order kind of glues it all together, you know, for us. And then I don't think we sound that much like them all the time. I mean, we kind of can when we want to, but through that lens is often kind of what how we're working.
Yeah, that's just your influence. I mean, you can just, I mean, Van Halen wasn't Van Halen, you know, it wasn't just because they listened to Montrose. I mean, they love Montrose, right? But it's an inspiration. It's something that you take and then you make it your own, and you know, it's all you, then it becomes you. It's not you just mimicking somebody else, but
right.
So, you know, the 90s are such an interesting thing, and I'm curious about your take on it. So we talked a little bit how grunge came in and basically blew the world to bits. And I've had Chris McLernan from Saigon Kick on, and, you know, there's a band that could talk all about that, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, all the Jellyfish guys we talked about, and, you know, then they kind of, that blew apart and they went, but it's interesting. I think it's twofold, right? I think we talk a lot about the whole part about the grunge era and how much that changed everything. And then you had it, but I also think Napster had a huge effect on killing a lot of musicians, because it went from being something that if you could put out an album and make some sales, you could actually make money.
Right.
So Napster made it where nobody made any money, and it just killed it all. How was it for you guys?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we escaped it by really going defunct kind of like right into that run up. I mean, because I think that the Napster era was maybe like 99 to 2003 or something like that.
Yeah. It was in the 90s. I don't remember exactly what, but.
So, I mean, we were done. I mean, we put out a third album in, I think 99, but we actually didn't put any real push behind it. We did like a record release party, and that was really the end of the line for us. And And we knew it at the time. So it wasn't sort of like it didn't, I mean, it may not have gone anywhere, but we'll never know, because all we did was we played one show and we sold a few, online that we mailed out ourselves. And then we just sort of let it be. But our second record, which had national distribution and radio support, and we played a lot of shows in California, we didn't really play outside of California other than playing on Star Search in Florida.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. But
yeah, but with that record was 95. So its arc was probably a 95, 96. And I don't think we were running into anything serious with MP3s at that point or Napster. But you're right. I mean, you for us, you know, sort of waking up, you know, sort of Rip Van Winkling into, you know, 2020, and we're like, okay, we're really going to put this record out. And it's unrecognizable in terms of like, you know, where the money comes in or doesn't come in. The record sales piece is not, you know, it's not a leg of the table anymore. It's just promotional,
yeah,
sort of slosh. You know, you sort of slosh a little money out, you slosh a little money in. And it's really a break-even proposition. I mean, I was reading about, I think it was Paul Weller. I think he got 10 million downloads, and they said he made some like $8,000 or something.
I know, it's insane.
Yeah, yeah. It's like this is somebody who should be able to say like, I'm just monetizing the faithful fan base here in a really simple way, like by like writing some songs and having them buy them.
Right.
But man, it's been thinned all the way out. So it is funny, like when you watch like, you know, Jay-Z or Taylor Swift complain about this, but you know, more power to them. They're complaining on behalf of everybody else.
Right.
So yeah.
Well, it has just become where you tour to make money. The album did, where it used to be, you'd make money because you were touring to promote the album. Cause then the kids like me and probably you, you'd hear a band and you love them, you'd run to the record store the next day and buy it.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it was much more like the appearance was promotional and enough to pay for, you know, Motel 6 and some Denny's. And then you sold some records. You sold better records, the better you, or better amounts, the better you played. And sometimes you sold them right out of your own trunk, you know, and that was great. So yeah. No, it's different.
So let's talk specifically about this album, American Canyon. This episode will go live on June 12th. So from a timing standpoint, it's almost perfect, right?
Yeah, yeah, right on.
So specifically about this, why did you guys decide this was the time to do this?
Yeah, it was really that we were going to do this, meaning the record itself sort of emerged.
Yep.
We didn't really pick the timing so much. The key thing to making this record was Sham Rao, who's the other songwriter. He and I write together mostly, and in our classic configuration, he's the guitarist, I'm the singer. And the reason I say classic configuration is on this record, it's like everybody played everything. I still did all the singing, but you know, everybody was playing all sorts of things, switching hats. But he moved back to California around 2015. He'd been in he was in Southern California for a long time, St. Louis for a bit, and then in New York City for a number of years. So he and his family moved back to California, Northern California, in 2015. And so, you know, we went through the normal songwriters thing of cycling through your demos and showing each other some riffs. And we didn't immediately get right back in a writing mode, but once we did, it was like, it really worked. It really, like all the kinds of writing you can do, you know, you can help someone fix their song. You can sort of create a variation on someone else's song. You can just collaborate directly. You can kind of co-produce for the other person. All these sort of 3, 4, 5 ways of working with another person were all kind of hitting and very productive. And then along the way we were like, yeah, okay, we got 3 or 4 and, you know, maybe it's a project. Maybe it's just a collection of songs we put out someday. But the song American Canyon was the one where we were really inspired by this. We sort of hit upon this very modal, almost like not a lot of chord changes, kind of more just like this key and this kind of bluesiness. And then we decided to go as far as we could with no guitars at all. And actually that track has no guitars on it. And it's one of our heavier songs. So we thought that was kind of a fun little, you know, riddle to solve. How do you make a heavy, you know, kind of driving thing with no guitars and a lot of synths. And when we made that song, it sort of felt like it was, a thesis statement for the themes of the record. And then sonically, it was just head and shoulders above the rest of the stuff that we'd done. And it drove us to write more, but also to go back and rewrite the, you know, three or four tracks that we already had on hand. Some were rewritten pretty drastically. So that's why we got to the point where we were like, this is really a record. It felt like it was emerging as a very complete idea in a very specific sound.
Yeah. And I'm interested too. So, I mean, in the light, I mean, 20 years in some ways is long and it's short, but from, you know, I think we're pretty close in age as far as your life changes. So, I mean, in 99, I was a newlywed, no kids, no, you know, still haven't come. And now it's like, you got kids, you got jobs, you got, so is it harder to kind of, I mean, you're not putting the band back together per se as it was before, but making all those components work, is that part of the discussion too? How do we make this happen? Right.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty organic. I mean, the thing that paddles it along is if Sham and I are in a regular working pattern, which is actually mostly in person. I mean, we do use the online thing in terms of sort of picking up the pieces after a recording session, or we'll each have a couple edits going, and then we'll kind of adopt one as the sort of critical edit that'll become the master, and we kind of chase that one down. But a lot of it is sitting in a room, you know, with a drum set and a guitar, you know, either of us on either, or working with a sequence, or me like ad-libbing over piano or whatever.
Right.
If we're doing that regularly, it's sort of like the rest of it pretty much falls into place. The band rallies around songs, you know, and that's, we actually have a sort of friend of the band. He's almost like, you know, like our fifth band member from back in the day. He actually helped, finance a couple of our projects early on, but one of my best friends, John, he often says to me like, so sounds like you were having fun. Were you putting words to music? That's sort of him just calling me on, are you playing the sport that you're good at, or are you doing something else? Right. So sometimes it's like, oh, right, we were just playing tapes at each other. It's like, oh yeah, we were guitar shopping. Oh yeah, we were eating lunch, you know, but it's like, were you putting words to music, is the critical job, you know, really. That's when you know you're making the thing.
Right. No, that's interesting. Well, I will put in the show notes all the places that you can find it, because it'll be out when this goes live, and people, please check it out. I am interested, and we touched on it briefly, but for those people that don't, that Star Search was like a big deal. I mean, it was a big deal back in the day.
It was strangely a big deal. Yeah, I mean, I think it was pretty nerdy in real time, but then also it was sort of like...
I watched it all the time, man.
The proto-American Idol or the voice of its time.
Yeah, there wasn't really reality TV back then, per se. I mean, I think MTV, The Real World was really the first time that it really took off. So Star Search was kind of... And for those people who don't know, it was syndicated, right? It wasn't on a channel, like a network per se. You buy it out of syndication, but this is Ed McMahon. And
right. Yeah.
So let's talk, because I'm fascinated by this. So tell me about the story, how this all happened.
Yeah, no, it was funny. I mean, and some people ask me about it. They're a little bit like, why'd you do that? And I was like, well, it actually was strangely organic. So they sent a producer out to the Bay Area who was driving around here and actually sought out like sort of an authentic band was clearly their charge here. And they had Martha Quinn from MTV on that year that we were on. It was sort of a reboot of the series. I think they just did it for two more years, and then I think that was the end, but we were on one of those 2 years. So they sent this guy out, and he went to like our big cool record store here. I don't know if you know like Amoeba Records.
I've been to the one in LA.
Yeah. So there's an Amoeba up here. And then the other one here that's actually more local and in many ways more dominant is Rasputin's Records. So Rasputin's Records, Berkeley, is sort of this mecca of CDs and vinyl at the time and all this. And, you know, three floors of huge sort of it's a mega independent store, you know? And they popped in there and said, all right, who are the indie bands? And that year we had sold the most records of any unsigned band out of that store specifically, because I think we lived, you know, like 10 blocks away or something.
Anyways, friends and family and everybody else, right? Plus yeah, it was your real fans. It was our
backyard. Yeah. I mean, we were constantly gigging on campus at Cal and all this stuff, right? So they called us up and just said, hey, we want you to come try out for this. And they rented a rehearsal studio in San Francisco. And then we like popped in and played for them. And throughout, they were just like, yeah, we think we want you guys. And we were like, okay, weird, but interesting. And I think we had just recorded our second record, but it hadn't come out. In any case, we went down this road of them wanting us to play pre-recorded. And they said, okay, well, yeah, maybe you can sing live, but we're gonna have you pre-record the band. And then we said, well, then maybe we won't do it. And we were kind of, you know, sort of negotiating our way as this trip to Florida, to Disney World, sort of, you know, sat on the horizon. And we kind of like, we're really not going to mime on TV for you guys. I mean, like, we're going to be fish out of water, but we're going to do it for real, you know?
Right.
And we got it. We actually played completely live, and they, not all bands did. And we totally did. And we went, you know, and so we hung around in Orlando for about a week in a, you know, nice hotel suite with, you know, several bedrooms, and just had a great time, went to Disney World or the equivalent, or whatever, you know, Disneyland, Magic Kingdom, whatever they have there. We went to all those things for free all the time. And we played twice. We scored high and won, and then we scored medium and lost, and we were sent home. So yeah. That was it, you know, and we got to meet Martha Quinn, which was super fun. And she's really, really, really nice person, and wrote a song about it. Our second record has a song called Martha on it. And that's about Martha Quinn.
That's great.
Yeah. So
she seems like she'd be about 4'5" tall.
She's kind of like a woman kid. Yeah. She's a little person. Yeah. It's on our third album. Actually, our second album had just been completed. It's our third album. Nowhere Near You has Martha on it.
Right.
About Martha Quinn. Yeah.
That's funny. And then how much longer after you guys were done and it was in the can before it actually aired? It probably was a while, right?
Yeah, I think it might have been like 3 months or something. I mean, it wasn't terribly long, but it was nothing like real time, you know?
Right.
I remember people, you know, would see us around during that time and say like, oh, I thought you were in Florida. You know, it's like, well, they film 10 days and then they play it over, you know, 10 weeks. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah.
That's funny. It was just a different time, man. It was just a different time, but that's cool that you got, I mean, if nothing else, it's a great story, right?
It is. Yeah.
Free trip's a free trip.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of surreal, and it certainly was fun. And, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was slightly absurd and 100% fun. So
that's a perfect description of it. So, with the world opening up, Matt, what's the plan with, you know, albums coming out? The album will be out when this is on. What's the Jenny thing thinking about the next 6 months?
Yeah. Next 6 months. Let's see. Well, we've prepared to do, like a small format performance style, which we may trot out into the real world. So far, we're trying it out this week. We've done some tests. It works nicely, but so we have like a fairly strong PA in the room. It's semi-electronic, but with an acoustic piano in it as well. And, Shams both playing a guitar and triggering samples of himself playing the guitar. So it's sort of this like,
right.
Organic electronic thing. But we're doing that for a film competition in Brooklyn this week that we're like sort of the co-hosts of. So they're trotting us out there, and we're going to be guest hosts, and we get to play a couple songs on that.
You're flying all the way to Brooklyn from Berkeley.
No. This is out of my house. This is the live stream thing. Yeah. This is sort of the 50-50 thing is like, are we going to be live streaming for another couple months, or are we going to be able to poke out there and, you know, open a show for somebody or make an appearance somewhere. So we're just kind of ready for either one. And then I've got a number of like film oriented things that I'm looking at. I have a soundtrack that I'm supposed to do before the end of the year. I guess it's a film score, not a soundtrack. It's actually like composition. And there's the possibility of actually, this is completely crazy, but I think I might do it. And I've talked to a couple of people about it who think it's possible to actually create a script around this album, and figure out if it could be a series or a movie. That's so those are some of my bigger dreams about that. And then if you ask the band, I think they want to make another record. Like they wish they could have made another record like last week or something. So, because this record's kind of, you know, we're doing the outreach and running up to the release of it and the release of, actually there's a video that's coming out alongside the song American Canyon, I think June 11th. So it'll be right in real time with our podcast here, that we're intending to put, out in a bunch of channels and also to enter in some film festivals. So that's another whole thing. But yeah, again, the musicians in the band who aren't sort of as nutty as I am talking about, you know, this, that, and the other, I think they're ready to make a record. So we're definitely going to make another record, I'd say, in the next year. And we'll figure that out too.
Right. Well, it's so interesting. You know, I talk to people from all around the country, and it's interesting. And I don't want to get to devolve too much in this because I kind of feel like, you know, my parents they remember World War II and it's all this shared sacrifice and everybody was together. And I kind of feel like, for lack of a better phrase, our generation and not us personally, but collectively shit the bed on all this. Like, we just did a horrible job. And then, you know, and I just, it's just exhausting to me that people can't, you know, just act like adults and trust science, but whatever.
Yeah.
So
I'm with you.
Yeah. It drives me up the wall. So around the country, you know, Matt, it's so, you know, so obviously California has been very careful and Gavin Newsom's leadership and stuff like that. So where you guys are, and I talked to Nashville guys, I mean, they've been playing for weeks out, right? It's just like, it's this strange, and I'm seeing the national bands, like the people that were supposed to, like Matchbox 20 was supposed to be here.
Yeah.
They postponed another year. And these are all the bands that I had tickets to. So this is why I'm going to date myself.
Right. Your cancellations are coming in and they're going from August, September, October, 2021 to 2022.
Right.
Yeah.
But then you've got like, and actually I'm going to talk to him next week. You know, Alex from Everclear. Everclear is going to be here next month. And it's just like this mishmash. And I don't know, like, when's the right time to go? Who wants to get out? Is it a part of the problem too with playing out live on these touring acts that there just isn't enough people, the roadie types people? Anyway, this is strange calculation. Like, who goes out? When do they go out?
Right.
What do they decide? Anyway, so it's just fascinating to me. I'm playing four times this week. It's nuts.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, they're all but one out. It's my first indoor gig Saturday or Friday in 15 months.
Oh, wow. That'll be a lot of fun, though.
Yeah. But yeah, we're all vaccinated. You know, me and my singer, we've been vaccinated a long time. It's just interesting. And is that how you guys feel, too? Is it just strange watching the country and what people do?
Yeah, I mean, right. There's a wide range going on. Yeah, I mean, of course, it is strange. I mean, and I think that where we are now, I mean, actually, where I am physically right now, there's like a 99% vaccination rate in my zip code.
Right.
So that's one of the things too, where you kind of go like, so I think as long as we don't go to something that brings people from 200 miles away, we're extremely safe here at this point.
Yeah.
But also a little shy to reopen. I mean, it's, you know, California is running on tech money. I mean, you know, that's a funny thing too, is people are putting down Gavin and California a bit for, you know, being too careful. And it's like, well, guys, we do know how to run businesses here. You know, it's like, it's very money. It's very capitalist here. Don't worry. It's not a bunch of people, you know, eating tofu in the hot tub here.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got that also, but it's like, don't worry. People know how to win here.
I think you have fourth biggest economy in the world, right? If you cut
as a country, California. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're behind Germany or something. Right. So, but it is a funky thing though, because you do see that amount of just shyness to reopen and not wanting to take a step backwards if we have to. Oddly, I think, you know, California would be able to generally take a step backwards if we had to. And I don't know. I mean, I at this point, I'm like, I'm just glad it's not, you know, June 2020, because things were not headed in the right direction. And now at whatever rate it is and by whatever crooked path, we are headed the right direction.
Right.
You know, we're going to get there. So,
No, it's fascinating. I have a good friend, actually. She's my wife's cousin, but she's a professional jazz singer out in LA. And we've recorded together and stuff, but it's just, and she's just like, she's just had it, man, with all these, because, you know, the people, and her husband's from a rural part of Kansas, so that's part of it. So these are people that, you know, they only talk to each other. They only watch Fox News. They only, right. You know, it's like this, it's like this complete dual reality, right? Like, it's just like, this yeah. place, it doesn't exist. And they would get calls from people being like, you need to leave California. I heard you can't even leave your house. And like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, I just got back from the grocery store. Right. It's just like, it's so stupid. It just saddens me that we just couldn't get our act together collectively and just be like, you know what? We're going to be smart. Going to listen to science. Then when the vaccine comes out, we're going to get the vaccine.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's no big deal. You know? My kids have to, I don't know if you have kids or not, but
I do.
You always have to give them, you know, to get your kid in school, you always had to show the vaccination, like they won't let your kid in school. So it's not like some grand conspiracy against you anyway.
Right. Yeah.
It's exhausting.
I know.
Well, I want to keep you all day, but let's talk about people hearing this, and I'll be sure to play some of your music too. And we'll talk about that in a second. What's the best way to follow your band?
Yeah. I mean, we're quite active on Facebook, Instagram, and then our website, thejennything.com. Those are the best places.
And why is it the Jenny thing?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's just a name that we, we were walking down the street when we were like, you know, 18 or 19. And I think it was along the lines of, oh yeah, that was the thing he had with that girl, Jenny. And it was like, oh, Jenny had that thing. And how about that thing? Anyway, we kept the thing and the Jenny kept coming up. And anyway, It's just the statistics of being born. You know, it could have been the Stephanie thing or the Lisa thing or whatever, but we were the Jenny thing. and we don't think that much about the, I mean, you know, it's our name. When the four of us are together, that's what we get called. So yeah, it's not that clever.
Well, the biggest band, rock band on the planet probably right now is the Foo Fighters, and Dave Grohl will be the first person to tell you that it was a stupid name and it was just a placeholder. He wasn't.
Right. It was going to be his little demo tape or whatever.
Yeah. He was like, if I knew it was going to be successful, I would have come up with something a lot better than that. But he just didn't want everybody to be like, hey, it's Dave Grohl by myself. Right. Well, I appreciate meeting you and thank you. It's so nice that you actually listened to a podcast episode. That was very kind of you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I like it. No. And I like that you're a practitioner and very absorbent, which is awesome. You're. No, I like your niche. So.
Cool. I appreciate that, man. Well, you take care. I don't know if you'll ever be here, but if you are, look me up and I'll be happy to show you. You know, it's a great music town.
That would be great. Oh, I would love to do that. Yeah. Actually, I was just talking to he's a friend but I've never met him. He's actually an online friend, but I think he's now in Alabama. But I was thinking about doing a Clarksdale blues kind of thing, maybe some Nashville. I've been to Memphis a couple of times. I mean, I know that's not right around the corner from you guys, but it's I do like getting into these slices of you know, sort of the anthropology of American music and just the specificity of. I mean, I love food and music, so.
Well, this is a town for that, brother. Because
yeah.
Hey man, it's so nice to meet you. I'll let you get back to, but I really dug the album. So.
Oh, thanks so much. No, and really appreciate getting to be on your show, Jamie. So thank you. Power, venom, takes a minute just to bend them. Our body's got a shot for the victory. Just usher in a fresh fidelity.
Matt Easton, everybody. Matt, thanks so much for the time. And down in the show notes, you can follow the Jenny thing. Want to see, listen to the album, do all those good things, buy it. It's down there in the show notes. And if you know me at all, you knew I was going to find the Star Search clip, right? I mean, that just wasn't actually going to happen. So down there, too, is a link to the YouTube clip back in the 90s when the Jenny thing was on Star Search. Ed McMahon, Martha Quinn, you know it. It's fun to watch. So check that out. So that's going to do it for this episode of Trading Force. Next time, I have a pretty good idea who I'm having on, but it's not yet confirmed. So it's a mystery guest, people. You're getting a mystery guest next time. So you're just going to have to wait and see. But in the meantime, do me a solid. If you dig what I'm doing, give me a review on Apple Podcasts. Give it a thumbs up. Share it with friends. Helps drive traffic. I appreciate that. But that's it for today. So go out, support live music, and we'll talk real soon.
Bye bye. Monster, I'm a shadow brother. I'm playing by the dumpster. In the shadow of the doubt, I've forgiven you. Monsters of mercy and sinners and gods. Monsters of mercy and sinners and gods. Monsters of mercy and sinners and gods. Monsters of mercy and sinners and gods.